Here it is.
From deep inside your radio.
From New Orleans, Louisiana, ladies and gentlemen, where just a couple of weeks ago, the Daily Beast, this is Tina Brown's online news magazine thing, sponsored a conference on innovation. You know, trying to jumpstart innovation in America. Of course, the keynote speaker was General Stanley McChrystal. But it was a conference about innovation, I say, and it started me thinking. And Friday night, as I watched a certain basketball game, I realized, yes, we still innovate in this country. Where else could one have invented the T-shirt cannon? Nowhere else, I say. No one could have thought of it. No one could have thought of it being of any use at all, except us. That doesn't mean we're number one. We're not number one. According to a new report by the National Science Foundation, the U.S. now ranks 22nd among the world's nations in the density of broadband internet penetration, pardon me, and 72nd in the density of mobile phone subscriptions. But we invented the T-shirt cannon, and that's good enough for me. And now, news from outside the bubble, right here at the top. I swear, if this is true, a lot of thinking. From The Independent on Sunday in London, secret documents revealed that UK government-funded experts were warned nearly 30 years ago that tranquilizers later prescribed to millions of people could cause brain damage. The Medical Research Council agreed in 1982 there should be large-scale studies to examine the long-term impact of benzodiazepines after research by a leading psychiatrist showed brain shrinkage in some patients, similar to the effects of long-term alcohol abuse. However, no such work was ever carried out into the effects of drugs such as Valium and Librium, and doctors went on prescribing them to patients for anxiety, stress, insomnia, and muscle spasms. The documents, which were seen by The Independent on Sunday and marked closed until 2014, do not make it clear why no work to test these findings properly was ever funded. The Department of Health has no record of a meeting on the subject. The critical questions posed in 1982 remain unanswered, although 20 studies into the drug have been funded in laboratory animals in Great Britain. Current guidelines for doctors say they should be prescribed for a maximum of 4 weeks, but some people become involuntarily addicted within days, unable to stop without withdrawal symptoms such as burning sensations, distorted vision, headaches, and even fatal seizures. Some patients who've taken the pills for months or years have enduring neurological pain, headaches, cognitive impairment, and memory loss. But 30 years after the Medical Research Council in Britain first considered the idea, there is no medical research to confirm whether these symptoms are due to drug-induced brain damage or not. A question mark, ladies and gentlemen. News Outside the Bubble, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Huh? Now news of Outback. A nearly $70 million fine announced Friday against one of the U.S. government's largest Afghanistan contractors is an apparent record war zone settlement. New Jersey-based Lewis Berger Group, which has overseen the construction of roads, power plants, and schools across Afghanistan, acknowledged it had knowingly and systematically overcharged the U.S. government, agreeing to pay $69 million in criminal and civil penalties. Berger's antagonist was Harold Solomon, a Haitian immigrant and former employee. He says he plans to donate part of his whistleblower's award to a Haitian nonprofit. He went to law enforcement authorities in 2006 with evidence including CDs full of data that the contractor had defrauded the government of millions in a complex accounting scheme, which beats those simple accounting schemes every time, ladies and gentlemen, in case you're thinking about it. It billed taxpayers for overhead and other costs that had nothing to do with its government contracts. A Lewis Berger spokeswoman, Holly Fisher, said the settlement meant the firm could continue to do contracting for the U.S. government in Afghanistan. And that's the good news. McClatchy Papers first reported the nature of the allegations and the existence of the whistleblower suit in September, which is why you haven't heard about it. Till now. And the Iraqi Interior Ministry Inspector General recently determined that those wands used by police as the frontline defense in the country's fight against bombs, you heard about these 2 years ago on this broadcast, the Inspector General of the Iraqi Interior Ministry now says they're worthless. The finding was unsurprising. For years, U.S. military officials have called the device a scam. The British government this year jailed the manufacturer of the gadgets on fraud charges. But senior Iraqi officials, including the Interior Minister, continued to insist the critics were uninformed. The officials maintained the devices, supposed to detect explosives inside vehicles, had saved countless lives. When faced with the Inspector General's findings, Interior Ministry officials did not pull the devices from hundreds of checkpoints. Instead, they shelved the report, quietly granted immunity to the official who signed the no-bid contracts, and buried any reference to the report. The devices remain ubiquitous across the new Iraq, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, we're proud. Hello, welcome to the show.
2, 3, 4.
This is Le Show. Before the 2005 flood, listeners to this program may remember that I did a series of programs with New Orleans musicians, primarily piano players, because there's such a plenitude of amazing piano players in this town. But a couple weeks ago, I saw an acquaintance of mine, whom I'd never seen play before at a jazz club here in town, do some special things with a guitar. And I invite him to be with us on the broadcast today. Phil DeGree. Phil, welcome.
Thank you, Harry.
Now, I know you from your wit and wisdom, I guess. You are a notorious... would you say you're a performance artist?
It depends where that is happening. But
well, let's say in Jackson Square on Mardi Gras Day.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I could you could call it that.
you tend to focus on the absurdities of certain religious figures and practices. We were talking before we went on the air about your affection for the great Bob Tilton, the TV evangelist of yore.
Yeah, that's a whole nother genre than these guys that come into the city on Mardi Gras preaching and telling everybody they're going to hell. Mm-hmm. So I just couldn't think of anything more fun than to go out there with my bullhorn and just ask some questions, you know, and dress up like the Pope. Okay, so.
Okay. So you,
what are you doing in front of my church?
There's that little twist.
This is my church. Get out of here.
Yeah, it is. It what they do is very strange. What you do is fascinating. And I'd also seen your collection of books that you'd laboriously retitled and reimaged to a similar effect. But then there's this thing, and after I saw your gig, I started talking to musician friends of mine here in town. I said, I saw this gig by Phil DeGree the other night. And they said, oh, yeah, he's amazing. As if, yeah, everybody knows, and where have you been? So... tell me a little bit about how long you've been... What is that instrument you've got in your hands, first of all?
I call it a guitarp. This is the third one that's been made for me. And it's basically a seven-string guitar with a high A. And it's got 10 additional strings in the upper register. Second to last register on the piano. And I tune them basically to the black keys on the piano, so D flat. And I look at the regular guitar as the key of C. And it evolved.
Your guitar is tuned differently.
Well, the guitar, the regular guitar, the seven strings are pretty basic. And it's got a high A's. Then I have this string. And I got inspired to do that from this guy, Lenny Bro, who was my mentor, and I idolized him. And he died in 1984, but I got to do some hanging with him in my earlier days. You know, I went to Nashville and sought him out. And he introduced me to Chet Atkins on my 25th birthday. I happened to be in Nashville, so that was pretty inspiring. But he is the one who started with this high A string, whereas before there was a low A, like George Van Epps, Bucky Pizzarelli, all these older jazz guys. Lenny came along and started doing all this Bill Evans compositional work on the seven string with a high A, and I had to get one. So I got a classical guitar just like he had. Had the high A, used fishing line because nothing would tune up to pitch. This is all Lenny's idea. And I had that for a couple of years, and I kept thinking, well, I love this seven-string idea, but I need an electric guitar. I'm not really, the classical's fine, but I want to play electric solid by. So I commissioned a guy named Jimmy Foster to make the first harp guitar. And so it was just a big experiment. Mm. The problem was there were little things that weren't right with the guitar. So finally I met Ralph Novak, and Ralph is into this fan fret system, which makes my bass string longer and it makes my treble string shorter just by the nature of its design. That's what I needed.
When you say fan fret system, I'm staring at your guitar and the frets closest to the bridge are angled. Oh, God.
It's like a big quotation, like a slanted, and then in the middle, it's perfectly straight.
Perfectly straight.
On the 12th fret.
Yeah, and then up at the top of the neck, it's going the slanting in the opposite direction from where it started out.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. So each string has its own intonation, and I love it.
That looks a little difficult to learn to play.
It's not really a big deal, and then I can do certain things on this guitar that I can't do on a 6th string, you know? And most importantly, I'm tuned up to pitch, you know, without worrying about breaking the high A string. Mm-hmm. So.
And then these harp strings, how did that come to be?
That was a big, it was a big question. How do I tune this? So I had many tunings and kept retuning, and I said, well, I can't be doing this in the middle of a set and keep tuning. So after a few years, I decided on this D flat tuning after struggling with this classical piece for years, Claire de Lune, which mm-hmm. is in the key of D flat. Mm-hmm. So I just left it there. I said, let's just revolve everything around there and just let it be. So
you're in Claire de Lune tuning now.
Yeah.
Claire de Luning.
Yeah.
if I may. Now, are you a New Orleanian by birth?
Born and lowered.
Where? Where'd you go Mid-City. To school? People have to ask you that, right?
Mid-City.
Yeah.
I went to Jesuit High.
That
my,
explains
my least favorite high.
That explains everything, doesn't it?
I actually went for 2 years and successfully failed out of there and went to boarding school in Bay St. Louis.
Oh.
But the cool thing was that I got to come home and, you know, go to therapy, meaning play guitar and music. And,
right.
So it was just a weekend, you know, or during the week. It wasn't like I went to North Carolina to a military kind of a thing. And I started playing guitar and quit playing football when I went to boarding school, which
probably was a good choice.
It was a good choice.
And did you start playing in clubs in your teenage
years? Not really. What happened, I got out of high school and I was into Dylan and the Beatles and Clapton. And
really?
Yeah. And then my mother gave me a Chet Atkins record the last year of high school. And I said, whoa, what's going on here? And I kept loving it and trying to, what is he doing? All this, it was mystical, you know? So then I started studying with this guy who knew how to play like Chet, and he knew how to play jazz. Great teacher named Hank Mackey, and he showed me a lot of the Chet Atkins secrets that I couldn't hear. You know, I didn't know how to do. One being harmonics. That kind of idea was like, wow, what is that? So, and then Hank introduced me to everything from, you know, Chet to jazz, and then Lenny Bro came along, and that was the mind blower.
Mm.
Lenny Bro and Ted Green is another great teacher. But Lenny encompassed so many different styles and genres and was just such an amazing player and had such great ears that, you know, I just found him and went and studied with him. And after he was alive for about a year when I got my first harp guitar, and he came to town and checked it out and got him a gig, and we hung, and that was a great time. But you know, it's been a hard tune-up session with this thing, especially in this town, where nobody tunes up. If you think you're in tune, you're overlooking something.
Well, why don't you give us this little sample of what you do with that thing?
Okay.
He's standing up, ladies and gentlemen, as if to play. Thank you. That was a pastiche. Your mind has almost a hummingbird quality to it, both in terms of the way you play with words and what you did at that gig. You sort of grasp songs, pieces of songs, parts of riffs, and then dart along to the next one that seems associated. You've made an associative jump. Is that the way you work, or is that just my?
This is part of my ADHP, which it's basically attention deficit hyperactive pleasure. Since
it's you don't
who can stay on one tune for more than a couple minutes playing solo guitar? You know, it's like, okay, well, you don't like this one, maybe you'll like this one.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's a series of cause and effect kind of a style. It's like, what can go with this? How can this go with this? And,
so you're quilting.
Yeah. It's a blanket statement, but
it is. And when did you start doing playing professionally? Or do you?
That was it. it's sometime after I started studying with Hank. I started teaching. And I started doing wedding gigs, and I played in a swing band with him and a violinist and a bass player, just strings, hot strings we were called. So we played swing music mostly and played the Jazz Fest for years. And then started doing solo gigs with, you know, private parties and concerts and clubs and stuff like that, and just trying to get a solo repertoire going without too much stumbling.
You were, I think, commenting more than once on the irony of your playing at a jazz club and noting that this was not jazz that you were doing. But there seems to be a huge, or at least a significant improvisational part of it, as you were saying. You do dart about. And
right.
Is that ad hoc or is that practiced?
It's a combination. Like I'll be playing, I've played some tunes for 25 years now, but I always try to do it different. You know, I'll play the Over the Rainbow medley and just try to do something different that I might like.
You did one. I'm going to sort of nudge you in the direction of doing it if you're at all amenable, which was this medley of TV show themes.
Oh, yeah. Started out with a...
Thank you. More with Phil DeGree moments from now. But first, the apologies of the week.
Who you were?
We're so sorry.
Producers of Jersey Shore have apologized for a scene in the October 28th reunion show in which members of the cast referred to a female club goer as a tranny. The scene featured Mike, the situation Sorrentino, flirting with a blonde at a Miami nightclub. If you have to think about it, it is a tranny. Stay away, the cast member said. MTV later apologized in a statement. We appreciate the gay Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, voicing concern about the reunion special. The segment in question was certainly not meant to be insensitive, but in retrospect, we realize it was offensive to some viewers. We sincerely apologize. MTV apologizing, ladies and gentlemen. Dateline Campbellford, Ontario, the national president of the Royal Canadian Legion, like the American Legion, but Canadian, has apologized for a racist incident at a Halloween party at an Ontario branch, which has since been closed during an investigation. Two men, one dressed as a member of the Ku Klux Klan, the other in blackface with a noose around his neck, were awarded first prize in the costume competition. I sincerely regret the incident that happened, said the leader of the organization. I also want the citizens of Canada to know, and the members of the organization to know, this behavior is not condoned by the Legion, nor is it reflective of its members. The Legion's Ontario Command has launched an investigation. The man who wore the costume has since apologized. His son said his father realizes he should have thought it over a little bit better and dressed as something else. Most Legion members are concerned the controversy has erupted during its most important campaign of the year to sell poppies. European Enlargement Commissioner Stephen Fule, F-U-L-E, has welcomed the important step forward toward reconciliation represented by visits by Croatian President Ivo Josipovic and Boris Tadic to Vukovar, site of an atrocity during the 1990 war in former Yugoslavia. During a visit to a memorial to 260 people murdered at Vukovar, Tadic expressed his apology and regret. Neil Prendeville, an Irish radio presenter, wept on air as he apologized for allegedly exposing himself on a flight home after an evening at a top London restaurant. His food so good it made you strip. Prendeville broke down on his morning show after a female passenger complained he'd opened his trousers in front of her and two air hostesses. The broadcaster said he had suffered a blackout and blamed a combination of drink and painkillers for his actions and memory loss. And memory loss. Dateline Warner Robins, Georgia. Two Warner Robins city council members at odds over a comment about a cotton field shook hands this week. John Williams publicly apologized to Darren Lee for the exchange that happened during a pre-council meeting. Lee said he forgives Williams but can't forget the remark. Williams told Lee he was sorry for the comment he made 2 weeks ago during that exchange at the last council meeting. Lee told Williams he wasn't in a cotton field. Williams replied, "You should be." Williams said this week, "I'm sorry for it, and I apologize." A Georgia state lawmaker at the center of a racially charged picture told her side of the story. Representative Terry Lynn Weaver posed with someone dressed in blackface as Aunt Jemima for Halloween. We see a pattern here, ladies and gentlemen. Weaver said when she posed for the picture with her pastor, she did not know the photo was going to create controversy. It was fun, done in innocence. My friend is dressed up as syrup. His wife was going to be a pancake, said Weaver. I never intended to offend anyone. I took the picture off my Facebook. I apologize if it ever meant to offend anyone. By the way, that was in Georgia. Later, corrected version has that in Nashville. Still, Don Imus went into a commercial break this week. The commercial for the Cars for Kids charity began to play, and on the air, Imus said, "Shut up and go to hell," as the music jingle played, not realizing his microphone was still live. Soon after, he said, "I should give you my Bentley, you morons." The next day, Imus offered an on-the-air apology, saying he didn't realize his mic was on and that he always makes comments off air. Saying, "I didn't realize, I didn't intend for the sponsor to be listening, to believe that's how I felt about the little children. I would encourage all of my rich friends to turn their cars over to Cars for Kids." BBC has apologized to Band-Aid over reports claiming millions of pounds raised by the charity for famine relief in Ethiopia had been used to buy arms. Corporation says it apologizes unreservedly for the misleading and unfair impression which was created. In a historic move, the American Dental Association has apologized for not taking a stand against discriminatory membership practices before the mid-1960s. And after months of outrage from Native Americans over a perceived racist comment, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg apologized in a way that made it appear some Indians weren't offended by his words. I don't know that there were many Indians offended. If they were, I apologize to them. Nobody intended to do that, he said. He was addressing fallout from a series of Old West-inspired comments he made to local press in mid-August. I said this to David Patterson, the New York governor. I said, you know, get yourself a cowboy hat and a shotgun. If there's ever a great video, it's you standing in the middle of the New York State Thruway saying, you know, read my lips. The law of the land is this, and we're going to enforce the law. Many Indians, including tribal leaders, protested the statement, especially in New York, noting many of their ancestors were shot and killed by colonists. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now more with Phil DeGree.
Were you an obsessive TV watcher as a kid?
Not so much as after 10 years passed by, and then there was cable. Then I saw what TV did to me. So then I kind of started getting obsessed with audio dubbing. Everything from Jimmy Swaggart crying and confessing to Andy Griffith playing guitar. I put in my own audio and lip sync and just went crazy with that. It was like a therapeutic hobby that I went through for like a good 5 or 6 years in, you know, the '80s into the '90s. And,
has it occurred to you that if you had done that during the YouTube age, you'd be a viral star today?
Yeah. I see the stuff on there. It's just amazing. And plus I was working with, you know, I was riding a camel as far as technology. Mm-hmm. It was like really hard to lip sync, you mm-hmm. know, and to get it going. Now it's so easy with computers. So, but it was fun.
And do you still do that stuff?
No.
Yeah.
No.
Mainly music now?
Yeah. And lyrics, you know, rewriting tunes, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you find it, I mean, you've basically headquartered in New Orleans all your life, right?
Yeah.
No, by no stretch of the imagination would people outside of here hear your music and say, yeah, that's New Orleans-style music.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
It's weird. Yeah, I've been asked that. Well, you don't sound like you're from New Orleans, and you don't talk like you're from New Orleans. But there's so many influences going on here. I remember my parents bringing me down to Bourbon Street. Actually, they didn't bring me down to Bourbon Street. We happened to be walking in a French Quarter around Christmas time when I was probably 10 years old, and I heard the two bands at once, you know, off the different corners, mm-hmm. and I found that pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And just going from that rock and roll mindset into Chet Atkins, and then that opening doors to the jazz world, classical, and then there's New Orleans, you know. And there's so many things going on that I was challenged into, like, well, I like Chet Atkins, but I like this bebop thing too. I want to study it. I want to get with this. And I love classical music, and I want to learn this piece, you know. So I was torn between many different styles, and still am.
But there's ointment for that, I think. Do you think that this, doing this incredibly individual style of music, is easier here than it would be somewhere else, or because you're out of the stereotype of what New Orleans music, whatever the stereotype is. I mean, you're not funk, you're not jazz, you're not R&B, you're not, you know, any of that stuff.
I'm not sure. You know, I would think maybe a different country. When you say
Belgium?
Somewhere different, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I'd like to go to Europe and float around there for a while. But it's rough in America, you know, doing a solo instrumental act. I mean, you have to be like Leo Kottke, and he even sings, you know.
Yeah.
So,
but you talk a blue streak though. No, you do. You maintain an entertaining stream of patter up on stage, I have to say.
Well, it depends who's in the audience, too. You see, you know, some people just get up and leave. That's...
Do you shock a lot of people in your gigs, do you think?
Hopefully, yeah. Some kind of way.
Yeah. So is there a part of you that's still like 18 or 19?
Months? No, there is. Always.
Yeah.
And, of course, getting old sucks, but it's better than being born again. So I'm just trying to, you know, keep a little comedy in the world here.
Yeah.
In my world.
Yeah. Who's your favorite religious personage on television now?
Well, nobody can top Robert Tilton.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like Segovia.
We were talking off the air about this, and you have to do a little of this. You had transcribed his speaking in tongues.
Yeah.
And done it as a blues.
That's how obsessed I got in the 80s with television and cable. And the lunacy of this guy coming on TV with that big Joker smile and that, you know, that pep talk spirit. And
the great hair.
Oh, the amazing hair.
And the beautiful set. Leave us not forget that gorgeous,
oh, yeah,
multi-room set.
Yeah. I found it to be very interesting to the point where I started memorizing his actual, what he calls, speaking in tongues.
Mm-hmm.
But he would go in from speaking English into speaking in tongues, like, there's somebody out there, oh, basata kito put, you know, that needs to make $1,000 vow, oh, bahaya, you know. And I found that pretty abnormal and unusual. And so anyway, I memorized several little tongues from him, if you mm-hmm. will, and put it into a blues mm-hmm. that I call Blue Tongues.
It goes something like this.
Yeah, it goes... But remember, this is all copyrighted by the Robert Tilton
Foundation.
Yeah, the Foundation.
Fellowship.
Madiki so double la double soya. Madiki so double la double soya. Quarta bacata shit di di di. Madiki so double la double soya. Alabaka Shika Ita Cordoba Santa Claus is coming to town.
You made up that last part.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of made up the last part.
I always wondered if he had that on cue cards when he went into tongues, but
I don't know. I thought that too, because it was so good.
But his eyes were closed.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah.
And just he probably studied his licks, you know.
And like we all have to.
And sang it in the shower, you know. I'm guessing, you know.
Bob Tilton in the shower. Now, there's a video. While you're up, I'm going to have to ask you to reprise another thing you did at Snug, which was the Beatles medley.
That whole thing?
Yeah. Do you feel like it?
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
Now, if people come to New Orleans and want to see you live, where would they look for you?
As far as solo, Snug Harbor, and then it's Chickiwawa, and a lot of stuff that I do is solo, private stuff, you know. Or I might go to Missoula, Montana for the Missoula Jazz Fest, which they call Jazzula. And somehow this guy heard me in New York who knew the promoter there, and they hooked me up. And so they fly me to Missoula every year. And so that's a cool gig.
Yeah. Not in the winter, I hope.
No, no, like April, and it's still snowing.
Yeah, of course.
You know.
So Snug and Chickiwawa, two of the Snug is one of the preeminent jazz clubs in New Orleans, and Chickiwawa is sort of a new venue.
Yeah, it's great. It's mid-city, and there's no smoking, which I really like. It's
fabulous.
And it's got a good sound system.
Every time I get disappointed when a club closes, like we lost Donna's a couple weeks ago, and then another club, it seems like something Newtonian, that there's a certain number of clubs that are in this city no matter what, and they always seem to sprout up even though the ones die, you know.
Hey, birthplace of jazz, I care for God.
Yeah. So play us out with something fearsome here.
I'll do this little 1 minute piece that I wrote.
Oh, cool.
It's called Time Flies and There's No Landing Gear.
Phil DeGree, thank you so much, man.
I appreciate it, Harry. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's Clean It Safe.
Hi, everybody. This is Tom Jones, Santa Monica, home of the homeless.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for dropping by. It's Clean It Safe. It's cheap. It's too clean to be safe to be cheap. In looking into the cause of a spike in tritium levels, there's that compound again, in a groundwater monitoring well in North End Power Station, Virginia, is looking into the cause of a spike in tritium levels. And it's not a compound, is it? I believe it's a isotope. In a groundwater monitoring well at the Louisa County plant. This is in Virginia. Dominion Power notified the Nuclear Regulatory Commission of the monitoring result this week. We noticed a small increase in tritium levels in one of our sample points. The sample in April showed a slight elevation. A follow-up last month revealed a higher reading. It's in an area where some underground pipes are located. Tritium is a radioactive form of hydrogen that occurs naturally and as a byproduct of electricity production at nuclear power plants, and seems to be leaking at nuclear power plants all over the country, judging by what we're collecting here. But on a related subject, Vermont Yankee, the nuclear power plant in Vermont, which began, at least to my ken, the shower of reports about tritium leaks, is for sale. Ladies and gentlemen, if you've always dreamed of having a nuclear power plant of your own, if you want to take the initiative to what the Republicans are calling our bright nuclear future, hey, why doesn't John Boehner pony up or bony up? Vermont Yankee is for sale. Entergy, headquartered here in New Orleans, right here in New Orleans, the company that owns Vermont Yankee, released a statement this week saying they're putting the plant on the market because it's best for shareholders. It's best for shareholders not to be owning a nuclear plant that emits
a lot of tritium leaks that are no danger to anybody. Energy CEO J. Wayne Leonard says any sale would include intense negotiation to keep on the 250 employees, although Vermont Yankee's been under scrutiny for that leak, and the legislature has voted against relicensing the plant in 2012, so those employees will be kept on maybe shutting it down. They'd be good at that. They know where the switches are. And Dayland Richland, Washington Energy Northwest Nuclear Power Plant near Richland has been rated one of two nuclear plants in the nation that are in the greatest need of operational and human performance improvement. The greatest need. That's not to say that none of the others have less needs. It's just that's congratulations, Richland area. And if John Boehner or anybody else wants to buy the Vermont Yankee plant, call Energy. They're right here in New Orleans. They're in the Energy building. Easy to find. Where else would they be, really? Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to go have a big brimming cupful of tritiated water. So that's it for this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz shortwave. In the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want at harryshearer.com, one of the locations, kcrw.com, the other location. Available on your smartphone through stitcher.com and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like me talking about the aftermath of the election next week, if you'd agree to join with me there, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. But wasn't it nice not to hear anything about the election today? Wasn't it like a breath of stale air? Like, you know, like Librium without the brain damage. A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and exile in Hawaii desks. The mailing address for this broadcast and the playlist of the music heard here on, available at harryshearer.com. Phil DeGree's records available, his CDs, that is to say, at louisianamusicfactory.com. Thanks to Wes Fontenot at Piety Street, the studio of the stars, and thanks to Jenny Lawson here at WWNO-FM, and thanks as always to Pam Halstead. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.